Dear friends, welcome to our meditation workshop. If you haven't signed in yet, please sign in. Thought maybe an interesting way to begin would be to ask, what is meditation? Or why meditate? Why do we meditate? Oh, I should ask first, before I ask that, let me say ask, raise your hand. As difficult as it may be to raise your hand, if you're a shy person. Okay, so we have a lot of shy people here. Please don't be shy. We don't have a lot of time. We need to move ahead. So when we ask a question, or when we ask for a view by raising your hand, please don't hesitate. Just go ahead and jump right in. It's fine. So, what are some reasons why we meditate? To calm, to become calm? Sure. Okay, to get centered? To get centered is fine. Because we like it. That's a really great answer. That is so good. Because it makes us act better. I think that reminds me of what I've heard Jack Lawler say. He says that he's a lawyer, so he's involved sometimes in a lot of hot situations at work. And sometimes he's the only person in the room who can keep their heads about them. And he said that he really notices the difference. If he has meditated in the morning, even if it was a really fragmented, scattered, seemingly non-productive meditation, he acts so much better. He's able to handle situations so much better through the day than if he hasn't meditated. Guess I would add that sometimes we can meditate to become happy. Sometimes we can meditate to gain some insight. Let's look at the first verse of Thais. Let's look at the first verse of Thais, 14 verses of meditation. So as we look at the first of the 14 verses, we see just as a bird has two wings, the practice of stopping and deep looking. The two wings depend on each other. Stopping and deep looking go in tandem. So right at the very beginning of these 14 verses, Thais is telling us that it's not precisely true that there's concentration meditation or what's called vipassana or insight meditation, that they need to go with one another. As we look at the exercises of the 16 exercises of the sutra, we see that at the beginning, there's much more calming, concentrating, stopping. And then as we go through that, we're kind of calming and looking at some of our feelings. We get to our mind. And then we get to concentrating and liberating the mind. So there's really a move at that point to much more insight as well as calming. And then the last tetrad, each of the four verses is called a tetrad. The last tetrad is very much involved with some of the deepest insights that the Buddha had to offer that can really liberate us, that can really give us a taste of freedom and happiness. So I looked at the emails of the people that I got who responded to my question about your meditation practice. And first of all, I was surprised how much meditation so many people had done. I'm not sure if that holds true for the people who didn't answer, but how much meditation has been done. But I also noticed that most of the folks who answered are really drifting, almost floundering in their meditation without a good, strong direction. I can tell you that Tay had a really strong direction in his meditation. And thanks to Tay, for 20 years, I've had a really strong direction in my meditation, the direction of these 16 exercises. Now, don't get me wrong. I practice other techniques, have at times incorporated other techniques. There's nothing wrong with taking a course at IMS or Spirit Rock. But the thing, the real key here is to be grounded in this practice, in Thay's practice and the Buddha's practice of Anapanasati. So Thay has told us that he believes Anapanasati is the way the Buddha taught meditation and practiced meditation. Let's do a reality check on that as we look into the texts, into the sutras, some of the more original sutras. One of them is actually called the Anapanasati Sutta. I think it's in the Majjhima Nikaya. And it's a really fascinating sutra. And it's unique, actually, in the canon, because the Buddha's, at the beginning of the sutra, it's the end of the three-month rains retreat at the Jeddah Grove that Anuttapindika donated to the monastic community. During the rains retreat, everyone stayed in place. They didn't wander. The monks, the bhikshus, didn't wander because the roads were terrible. The crops had just been planted. I think there were a lot of snakes around because of the rain, flushed out because of the rain. So the monastic community just stayed in one place for the monsoon season, for the rainy season. And I know that in the three-month retreats in our tradition, at the end of the three-month retreat, many of the brothers, I talk more to the brothers than the sisters, many of the brothers, if not all of the brothers, are really ready to leave the monastery because they've just been in the monastery for 3 months, seeing the same people, interacting with the same people. Everybody's ready to get a breath of fresh air. So I imagine that it wasn't maybe all that different in the time of the Buddha. And so the Buddha gathered everyone at the end of this rains retreat, and he said, "Bhikshus, you've been practicing really well. So what we're going to do is we're going to extend our rains retreat for another month." And right about there, I think some of the bhikkhus were going, "Oh boy, the big guy wants us to stay for another month." Be that as it may, the Buddha continued, "Send out word to all the bhikkhus who are in rains retreat along the Ganges River Valley, all of our other brother monastics, to come here to Savatthi, to Jeddah's Grove, and in 1 month's time, at the next full moon, I'll give a special teaching." And 1 month later, under the full moon, the Buddha indeed did give a special teaching. He offered the Anapanasati Sutta. Perhaps this was the first time. I know of no other point in the sutras where the Buddha tried, delayed ending a rains retreat and gathered the whole community of bhikshus that had been following him throughout the whole of what was then at that time India. It was actually Magadha, Kosala, and some other republics. Gathered them all to come to him because he had a special teaching. This is the only time. Another piece of evidence is that one time at a different three-month retreat, at a different rains retreat, the Buddha said to his bhikshus, "Bhikshus, I'm going to go into solitary meditation. The only one who should approach me is the one who brings me my meals." And the Buddha did go into a three-month period of meditation. At the end of those 3 months, he came out and said to the bhikshus, "Bhikshus, if practitioners of other sects ask you how the Buddha practices, how the Buddha has spent this rains retreat, tell them he has spent it in Anapanasati." Anapanasati means ana, in-breath, pana, out-breath, sati, mindfulness. Mindfulness of the in-breath and the out-breath. But it's much more than just being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath. At one point, the Buddha was teaching to a bunch of bhikshus, and a monk named Arita, who had been a falcon trainer in his lay life, who's actually a little bit of a foil for the Buddha in a couple of sutras. The Buddha asked Arita, "How do you meditate?" And Arita said, "Anapanasati, dear Lord." And the Buddha said, "How do you practice Anapanasati?" And the Arita said, "I know that when I'm breathing in, I'm breathing in. And I know that when I'm breathing out, I'm breathing out." And the Buddha said, "Yes, that is Anapanasati. I don't say that it's not Anapanasati, but there's a better way." And then he offered again the teaching on the 16 exercises or the 16 steps, the four tetrads, on that day as the better way to practice Anapanasati. Finally, those two and this next one are in something called the Samyutta Nikaya. Samyutta Nikaya is it translates as collection. Samyutta is collection. And in the Samyutta Nikaya, there are collections of Buddha, of sutras on various topics. And there's a chapter in the Samyutta Nikaya on various times when the Buddha offered the Anapanasati teaching. On this particular time, I think this is really speaks a lot, because sometimes when we see a sutra that really deifies the Buddha, makes him almost magical, we have a pretty good idea, a pretty strong instinct that was added later or changed as it was passed down orally through the years. If we find a sutra from the Buddha that seems to have been, that doesn't reflect all that well on the Buddha's teachings, then perhaps we want to really pay attention to that. How did that stay in there? That did stay in there, even though maybe it doesn't reflect as well on the Buddha as some of the other sutras do. And there's a sutra in the Samyutta Nikaya where the Buddha had been teaching the disenchantment of the body, looking at some of the things that are unappetizing about the body. And then he went into seclusion again for 2 weeks this time. He said, Bhikshus, the only one who should approach me is the one who brings me my meal. I'm going into seclusion for a fortnight. During those 2 weeks, a number of bhikkhus misunderstood the Buddha's teachings, grasped it completely incorrectly, and killed themselves. It's according to the sutras, they would take a sharp knife and slit their own throats. The Buddha came out of his 2 weeks of meditation and asked, oh, where are these monks? And he was told, dear Lord, these monks took to the knife. We can have to imagine that the Buddha was a little shaken by this. Have to imagine that. So he gathered all the bhikshus again together and again taught the Anapanasati Sutta as being truly safe way to practice, as the way to achieve deep liberation. In the email, I mentioned that something about a teaching, about Dharma teachers. It's something that referred to something that I've heard Tay say a number of times, which is that we can't really teach anything. We can only help people to touch their own inner teacher or inner wisdom. Several weeks ago, a number of weeks ago now, some of us were at a retreat at a hermitage down in southern New Jersey. We were down at, one afternoon, we were down at a shore at a sandy beach, sandy and rocky beach on the bay, on Great Bay, it's called. And I have to tell you that ever since I was a boy, or as a boy, I really had this strong desire to find a fossil. I wanted to find a fossil or two, and I never did as a boy, and I don't know that I ever had really as an adult. And we're walking along the beach, and Jenny was looking at some of the stones on the beach, and she picked one up and showed it to all of us because it was a fossil. There was a little creature imprint that you could see clearly in that stone. And that just really, well, actually, I was a little envious, but also said to myself, well, if I don't look at rocks, I'm not going to find a fossil. But Jenny said something odd. She said just maybe one little offhanded sentence about limestone. And that triggered something in me, and I watched the kind of rocks that Jenny was picking up to look at fossils for, and I said, I see. She's picking up these certain kind of rocks. And that was it. That was it. And now, just about every time I go back to that beach, I find a little rock with a fossil in it. Touched my inner teacher of knowing how to find a fossil. Just a couple of tiny little things transmitted something to me and allowed me to understand. And so hopefully that's a little bit of what's going to happen in the next 4 sessions. So I hope I've convinced you that Anapanasati is the way the Buddha practiced meditation, the way the Buddha taught meditation, and why practitioners of other Buddhist sects tend not to practice and teach in this way, I can't answer, because it seems just really clear to me that Tai is correct. Tai, when he started practicing, when he found the Anapanasati Sutta, he said, "It made me the happiest person in the world when I found the Anapanasati Sutta, when I found the sutra on the full awareness of breathing." When Tai ordained, I just found this, this is fascinating to me. I just found this out a few weeks back, that when Tai ordained at the age of 16 at Tu Hu Monastery, the novices were not taught meditation, were not encouraged to meditate, were really excluded from the meditation teachings for 2 or 3 years. For 2 or 3 years, what the monastic newly ordained novices did was mindful manners, study the verses on mindful living. And then when they had really cultivated mindfulness throughout their day in that way, they were allowed to begin meditation training. I found that really interesting. So let's look at the sheet that we handed out on the 16, what Tai likes to call exercises. That happens to be Tai's handwriting. He handed that out, a copy of this sheet out in 1998 at the 21-day retreat that I was fortunate enough to attend on the Anapanasati Sutta. I actually went away from that retreat, and that was how I started practicing meditation. It probably took me all summer. Retreat ended in June. It took me all summer to just remember, as I was sitting in meditation, the 16 exercises, and that's fine. That's fine. This is a lifetime project. So however long it takes us to remember it is okay. So we look at this sheet and we see the progression. We see that that this is really, really, really a bare bones outline. This is in sculpture. Sometimes they have a sculptor will have a wire armature, and this is almost like an armature for our meditation. It's a an outline that we need to fill out. An armature that we're going to use as a guide to adding a little bit of material here and there to really shape it. Or if you like, it's like a map. It's not, it's just a guide to show us some of the signposts and landmarks as we progress through meditation. So we'll be filling this out a lot as we go through. These are tools, and we hope to give you the tools so that with diligence you can really reap the benefits of the practice, including that taste of liberation that can sweep you along like being carried downstream by a swift current. Have a really wonderful quote here from one of our ancestral teachers, Tang Hoi. Anapanasati is the great vehicle used by the Buddhas to save or rescue beings who are tossing up and down and drowning in the ocean of great suffering. In another place, mind is like an ocean, constantly receiving from the rivers of the senses with deep currents. Mindfulness of breath allows you to see the countless seeds of feelings constantly being sown. Just a little bit more background. Tai in 1990 began offering 21-day retreats for the monastic community, of course, but really primarily for the lay community. Every 2 years, sort of, there were sometimes 3 years, or I'm not sure if there was were two in a row at one point, but so I guess there were about 15 of them, 15 or 16 of them, and at least two that I know of, and I think a third that happened before I started practicing, were full 21-day retreats devoted to Anapanasati Sutta. I was really fortunate, so fortunate, to have attended two of those retreats, two of those 21-day retreats on the sutra on the full awareness of breathing. I think one of the reasons, our Dharma teacher group, the meditation subcommittee of the Dharma Teacher Council, we got together and we're all thinking many of the same things. We're noticing that so many people say, Tai didn't teach meditation. And in fact, if you look at nearly every single one of Tai's 5 or 7 day retreats or 10 day retreats, and certainly the 21 day retreats, he always transmitted the 16 exercises. He gave Dharma talks on the 16 exercises. I think perhaps one of the reasons people don't understand that Tai was teaching meditation when he did that was because it wasn't interspersed that much with periods of meditation. So, of course, during this workshop, we'll have periods of meditation and periods of talking about meditation and periods of some meditation guidance, some sending out some signposts. I think that that's one of the things that we're looking at as possibly being really useful. I can tell you that this person has predominantly practiced with the Anapanasati Sutta for 19 years. Ever since that 21-day retreat in Vermont, when I heard Tai teach the Anapanasati Sutta. That was also a wonderful retreat because it was perhaps the last retreat where there was a great deal of meditation. Not as much as if we go to IMS, certainly, but I think we meditated perhaps four sessions a day. And that was just one of the most intense experiences of my life. So let's go into a period of meditation now. Let's just work with the first two lines, the first two exercises. Breathing in, the practitioner knows he is breathing in. Breathing out, the practitioner knows he is breathing out, in and out. Just that, just noticing. We'll talk a little bit later about the mind, but for now, just we'll sit for 10 minutes and just really concentrate on the breath. And then when we get a little bit established in the breath, we can notice, is the breath long or short? And it may be that you can't decide. well, is this breath long or is this breath short? And that's fine. Just don't worry about it. Then it's medium. One of the important things that Tai transmits about this particular step is to remain aware for the full length of the in-breath and the full length of the out-breath. In, 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 out, 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 for the full length, or in, out, or without even saying the words, just noticing that in and out. So we'll sit now for about 10 minutes and let us now listen to three sounds of the bell. Anybody else with a question?
I have a question about if Tai has ever suggested an alternative for people who find breathing to be a difficult anchor for their mind and meditation.
So let me, we have three questions. I'll say a few things and then we can see if there are more questions. Question about wandering mind and long or short, and for people who have difficulty following the breath. Why do people have difficulty following the breath?
If they've had an experience of being choked or not being able to catch their breath, or if they have some sort of physical problem with breathing that causes a panic reaction or with too much attention on the breath.
Right. So choking, illness, panic. You know, neither Tai nor the Buddha has said an awful lot about wandering mind. And I think people go to places like IMS and they really feel good that somebody talks to them about wandering mind again and again and again. But what Tai has said, so the Buddha a couple of times gave instructions for disturbing thoughts, but I think, and that's a separate topic as far, I think, But just wandering mind, what Tyus said is, whether we're brushing our teeth and we stop knowing that we're brushing our teeth, or we're walking down the street and our mind is wandering from away from the fact that we're walking down the street, or we're sitting in meditation and our mind wanders off. The only thing to do when we notice our mind has wandered, just smile and bring it back to whatever you're doing, to whatever the subject is. And don't say, "Oh, I'm a bad practitioner." I remember him once saying that when he meditates before a Dharma talk, he doesn't give one bit of thought to what he's going to say. He just meditates, which blows my mind because, for example, in that 10-minute sitting, I was some with the breath and some with, "Oh, I have to say this." And that's okay. And we just keep at it, keep smiling, letting go. It's not a problem unless we make it a problem. We can also try to cultivate a little bit more determination sometimes, but not too much. Because if we have too much, then we'll start going, "Oh, I'm a bad practitioner." It's really wonderful when we're completely concentrated. It's fine when we're not. I was studying with Bhikkhu Bodhi, and he said, a lot of times we just are kind of following our breath and our mind is off and a whole bunch of different directions for the entire period of sitting. And he said, "But I think that's useful anyway. Just that is fine." And like Jack said, when he sits and has a disturbed or sitting meditation, when his mind is wandering a lot, he still does better later in the day with his colleagues and opponents than if he didn't meditate at all. I think the real story is consistency. The real story is to meditate every day, to make it a point, to construct our lives. And I know that's hard because we're all busy. When I was working, I got up at 4:30 or 4:45 in the morning so that I could sit every morning. That is a kind of determination that we can make, the determination to sit every day. And if our mind wanders some days, that's okay. Just doing the best we can. Make sense? Good. So long or short, if long or short doesn't resonate for you, don't use it. Just stay with the full length of the in-breath and the full length of the out-breath. We don't want to overthink things. I just look at long or short for a couple of breaths and then move on to being with the breath. No reason to get a stopwatch. If we look at look at the poem. Tai says in verse 4, the breath and the footsteps generate the source of mindfulness, which enables one to recognize, to be in touch with the wonders of life. Tai really is serious about the depth of concentration that we can achieve and the insight that we can achieve in walking meditation. I know a few of you have heard this story before, but a lot of you probably haven't. It was a sort of warmish winter evening in the maybe temperature in the 50s in Plum Village. And I was staying in a dorm with five other guys. And there was no bathroom in the dorm. The bathroom was in a separate building across the way, maybe 20, 30 yards away, across the lawn. And, it's a big lawn and kind of garden, and there's a crushed stone path around the whole perimeter of the thing. So, the bathroom building was all the way on the other side. So it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and I had to, maybe 3:45, 4 o'clock, and I had to go to the bathroom. And so I got up, put on my shoes and my jacket, and kind of groggily stumbled out the door and started walking rapidly over to the bathroom block, and crossed right in front of, about 2 feet in front of, Tai and his attendant doing walking meditation early in the morning. And Tai was so present. Tai really, really does walking meditation. He, this is not just a little toss off to do when we're not sitting. Walking meditation is a serious practice. So that's one thing that comes to mind that Tai for sure taught. Okay, anything else?
Yes. I definitely see the value of focusing on these 16 things. But it seems to me they involve a lot of thinking. And when we went around, several people had said when they think of meditation, they think of, they implied letting go, finding peace. The whole notion of not thinking. So that's the part I don't understand. Did Tai and the Buddha have a place for not thinking? Because to me, it's not particular. I mean, maybe I can get there, but it's not relaxing at this point to need to be thinking all the time. That's what I thought we were trying to get away from. So I need some understanding of that.
So the question is around non-thinking, not thinking, and these concentrations. There's a difference between Upatissa tells us that the removal of discursive thought is the near cause of concentration. This is extremely important. Our mental energies are depleted by constant discursive thinking. With the conservation, clarification, and correction of our mental energies produced by Anapanasati, we could lead an intelligent, coherent, and meaningful life. So, we're making a distinction between discursive thought and concentrating. And what we're talking about here, and we haven't gotten to any of them except in and out, is that, for example, breathing in, the practitioner contemplates impermanence. And we're not getting there yet, not even close, not even close. But you see, we're breathing in and out, maintaining awareness of the breath, and focusing on one thing, stopping that discursive thinking. Stopping that constant, nonstop radio, NSR, Tai calls it that, nonstop radio running in our head, and using this to concentrate, really concentrate, focus the mind on one thing. And later on, we'll talk about whether it has to be in order or not and all of that stuff, but I think that kind of answers your question for now.
Is there anything about length of time?
Length of time. Yeah, there are a lot of things about length of time. Tai has suggested that 20 minutes is a good length of time. That we probably want to sit for at least 20 minutes to get settled and a little bit focused. Some people like to sit for an hour. Some people like to sit hour after hour. But then Ajahn Chah is one of my favorite teachers, one of my sub-teachers from Tai, who's he was this pithy old guy up in northeastern Thailand, and he said something like, just sitting all the time isn't necessarily going to get you enlightened. If just sitting all the time was the point, then chickens would be enlightened. But I think Tai really suggested 20 minutes as a good goal to enable us to settle down. Sometimes the longer we sit, the longer our mind wanders. It might be better to sit for 20 minutes in concentration than to sit for an hour going blah, 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 you know, with all this discursive thought.
I find sometimes when I'm trying to follow or concentrate on the breath that something shifts or switches, and rather than following, I end up kind of controlling it, like almost creating a pattern, and then I hold myself to the pattern, and then sometimes it kind of relates to a previous question. I get physical discomfort that I'm too much, things are too forced in some way. If maybe you could speak on that.
Sure. I I didn't mention earlier that it's really useful to have a half smile on the face as we sit down in meditation. It relaxes us and brings a little joy. Of course, the first thing is, if you notice that you're controlling the breath, to go, oh, I'm controlling the breath, and then stop doing it. If counting or in and out stops being useful, we can just become really exquisitely aware of the sensations rather than in and out. Let the body breathe. Just let the body breathe. I find sometimes in deep meditation or fairly strong concentration that I feel the in-breath coming in, the desire for an in-breath coming in from the distance. And then it arises. Then I feel the sense of having breathed in enough and just letting go. Because the out-breath is really mostly just a letting go. It's not we're not escorting the breath out like in some yoga practices. It's been useful for me to think about, this is pretty intense, but think about the mechanism, the physiology for breath, which I know we have some folks here who will probably correct me afterwards. But there are, there's a handful of brain cells in your brainstem. And what they're sensitive to, it turns out, is carbon dioxide. So it is the carbon dioxide rises. We're all healthy people, I presume, without COPD or something. As the carbon dioxide rises, those little bundle of cells in the brainstem start to create a sense of breathing in. And it just happens whether we're awake or whether we're asleep. And then as we're breathing in, there are just some stretch sensors in the lungs that say, okay, that's enough. And you relax and breathe out. Just that, just let the body breathe. The body will breathe. It's a very bad thing when that little cluster of cells gets wiped out. People have to remember to breathe rather than having it just happen automatically. I read that people die from lack of sleep when that happens, but I can't imagine that in this day and age they wouldn't just put somebody on a respirator and let them go to sleep. But obviously, if you get that much going on in your brainstem, you might have other problems. But just, and Tai calls that part of our store consciousness. Our store consciousness. We don't have to make any effort and we breathe. So, good.
Yes. Thinking about, I've noticed that when I have strong feeling and I sit with it, that my exhales are big and sometimes even loud. And I wonder if you, I'm thinking of sadness or anger or anxiety, and any thoughts about meditating under a strong feeling?
Sure. Our dear teachers had a lot to say about that, and I found it pretty useful. Meditating or with strong emotions. One thing is, one maneuver is to just hold that emotion, take care of it, like a mom takes care of a crying baby, you know, to cradle it, to know that it's there, to take care of it, that sadness. Anger's a little tougher. We haven't talked about where to sense the breath. There are some traditions that say you must sense the breath at the nostrils, at the nose, as it goes in and out. Tai notes that nowhere in the sutras did the Buddha say that. That was memorialized about the first century in a book called The Path of Emancipation by Upatissa. We can sense the breath wherever we would like. We can just know the breath. There's no rule against following it all the way in. But also, it can be really useful to sense the breath at the rising and the falling of the abdomen. Especially if we have really strong emotions, we don't even need to sit. We can lay down, put our hand on our abdomen and just breathe in and out, feeling the rising and the falling in the abdomen, taking care of those sensations. And if our agitation is so, or anger or fear is so strong that even lying down, focusing on our belly isn't useful, we can do walking meditation. There's a famous sutra where the Buddha, and Tyus taught this sutra too, talks about practicing with unwholesome thoughts, which is a little bit different than strong emotions, I think. But he said the first maneuver is to, that a carpenter, remember carpenters didn't have nails then, they had wood pegs. If there's a rotten peg, the carpenter will drive that rotten peg out with another wholesome peg. And like that, we can replace unwholesome thoughts with wholesome thoughts. There's a whole other bunch of them, but I think we don't need to go into those today. We haven't, I think let's look just a little bit at the next two lines. Experiencing the entire body, the practitioner breathes in. Calming the body, the practitioner breathes out. What does that mean? Well, there are a number of ways of experiencing the body in meditation, calming the body in meditation. One way the Buddha talked about was aware of the body from the hair on the head or the crown of the head all the way down through the soles of the feet. As we're sitting and breathing, we can go breathing in, I'm aware of the sensation at the crown of the head, and work our way down through the back of the head, the forehead, the eyes, the mouth and nose, the throat, the neck, the back of the neck, the top of the shoulders, in each place, noticing how it feels. Breathing and noticing, staying with the breath. The breath has to carry us through this. And when we sense tension, we can breathe into it, breathe into that place. If nothing else, that helps bring a little extra blood to that place of tension. I know that, and then going into the rest of the body, I know that, I don't know if anyone else ever has any anxiety, but I do. And I know that a lot of the time it manifests as a quivering sensation in the trunk and the belly. So noticing that, breathing in and out, calming that quivering all the way down through the back, noticing any tension in the back, down through the butt, the pelvis, the hips, anywhere where we find tension. Also noticing, where does it feel good? Where are things feeling okay? Where are things feeling pretty fine? The legs, all the way down to the feet, the tops of the feet, to the soles of the feet. Just noticing, that's called a body scan. So we have about 12 more minutes. Save questions on a body scan till next week, and there are So a few closing thoughts. One is, no Dharma police here. It's up to you whether you try and initiate and continue a daily practice or not. I'm not going to judge. Nobody's judging. More than a couple of people mentioned to me that they anticipate a huge drop off in attendance as we go through the weeks. I'm kind of hoping that's not true, because I've really, really tasted the incredible freedom that comes from practicing, from doing this practice. I'm not going to tell you that I experience it every time I sit down to meditate, but enough to say that it carries me along, that I've really tasted that liberation and freedom that comes from this practice. So I'd just like to share it. We got your money, at least to everybody. And if we don't have your money yet, the bucket's around somewhere. Throw 10 bucks in. There are two books that Tai has written. One is called The Path of Emancipation, which looks like this. These are the very lightly edited transcriptions of the Dharma talks that Tai gave in 1998 at that 21-day retreat. The other book that Tai has written about mindfulness of breathing is Breathe, You Are Alive. If you know, it's just up to you. I just mentioned that in case you're the kind of person who really wants to get a book and read about it, and probably even say to me, Dennis, Tai wrote this, but you said that. What's going on? And that's fine too. That's fine too. Finally, we have our regular Sangha gathering in about 43 minutes at 6:30, and you're all welcome to stay. It's a pretty strong place. If you, it's up to you. So, it's up to you whether you have a continued practice. It's up to you whether you keep coming back to this workshop. It's up to you whether you stay for Sangha. I hope this has been useful, and maybe we'll have a bell to stretch before we stand, because I certainly need to stretch.